Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Ryan Brushwood.
Yo.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, I'm over here.
Today, we're talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's latest, well, I mean, as we record this, you know, somebody will be listening a couple years from now, we'll be like, no, it's this. Latest movie, and I'm just going to say right now, we're going to spoil it. We're going to talk about spoilers because a big part of this movie involves a fictional version of Hollywood, and we want to talk about that and don't want to ruin anything. If you have any interest in seeing this movie at all, stop listening. If you're on the edge about seeing this movie at all, I say go see this movie and then come back.
Yeah. Worth seeing.
All right. Let's go around. Let's talk initial reactions. Who saw it first?
I saw it Thursday, 4 p.m.
I saw it Thursday, 5 p.m.
I saw it last night.
So, you saw it earlier because you're on Central Time.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I am not super familiar with Quentin Tarantino's catalog. I've seen some of the hits. But overall, I was kind of going in blind. I also didn't know much about the Tate and Manson stuff. And I walked out of that movie shaking my head. I had no idea what the point of, like, you know, Brian's going to talk about the magic trick of this movie. But I sat there and thought, why did I watch any of this? I think they're in it, and it's crazy because I think there's good scenes. I think the plot points in a vacuum and in connection with some of them are good. I think the acting's great. I think, you know, it's shot very well. I like, you know, the emulating old time types of film, and I thought that there's very good stuff in this weirdly bad movie. I don't know. That was how I walked away from it.
I will vouch that I can't remember the last time I was this close to just walking out of a movie.
Yeah. Like, I was checking my phone in the draft house, which is already a thing. But like, I was like, is this thing done yet? Are we going to do anything? Are we going to, like, that was the thing that frustrated me, is that the whole crux of it was this alternate history ending. And I think even that was to a very questionable conclusion.
Because you just didn't feel that there was a dramatic tension there.
It felt like it didn't. It felt like there are two things happening, right? Sharon Tate kind of having her, well, not even having her last days, because all of her stuff takes place 6 months before. But seeing a line of Sharon Tate, and then seeing the two interconnected lines of Rick and the other guy,
Cliff.
You know, seeing their interconnected story, and then at the end, the whole point is that they kind of brushed up against each other and saved their lives, but none of anything that happened before it really, I mean, it set up the characters, it set up that they can fight and that they drink and that, you know, they have a flamethrower. But I just felt like we didn't go anywhere. We didn't earn or do anything.
And so when you say that you're not familiar with the Manson Tate thing, like, because they and I don't know, because I don't know where the separation of, like, the stuff I saw at the draft house is and, like, the actual movie. But the movie, it felt like the movie begins with a trailer for a Manson murder movie. And then there was Stunt Rock right afterward. Was
so,
that the same day,
guys? I also arrived late, so I got in right as all the trailers were wrapping up.
Okay, so I didn't know.
That's a draft house thing. They didn't do it in every room.
Yeah, that wasn't okay. In the theater.
Oh, weird.
Okay, then yeah, then I thought that was part because it was after all the other stuff, so I didn't know whether or not that was Tarantino looking to start the movie like with this little pastiche. Mm-hmm. But that would be the only thing that I could have even thought of. Like, if you have no idea what happened when the Manson family came to Sharon Tate's house, it's one of the most grisly, violent, you know, certainly it's a murder that captivated the nation and you know, had far flinging ramifications throughout Hollywood and America. Then, yeah, like Ashley did not know about the Manson murders and was like kind of scratching her head as we left the theater. And I'm like, oh no, it's like, this was an alternate, you get it sprung on you mm-hmm. that this is an alternate history where the Manson murders yeah. never happened. And now Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski are different people.
Well, in this world, the Manson murders are when Charles Manson's followers got murdered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a self-defense tutorial of these people that come and try to murder.
I'm trying to like give the film some leeway because that's like, yeah, I didn't know that going in. And that's clearly a crucial part of it and clearly a thing a lot of people do know. So I'm trying to see the good. And I think there's a lot of really good stuff in that. But that one thing just the one thing it was just trying to bring everything together for. It felt I don't know.
Justin, go with your take now. Yeah, you're the second one to see it.
So I saw it. I loved it. I thought it was just a great character study. It certainly is a self-indulgent Tarantino movie. You know, we get not one but two elongated foot shot for like no reason because Quentin Tarantino said so. That being said, it was just, I don't know. I just love those characters. I personally saw where, you know, the story was going is, you know, there's DiCaprio coming to grips with kind of the tribulations of his career and the possible ending of it. Brad Pitt, who is like a really like kind of weirdly complex and like dark character because he's easily the most likable. And yet we just kind of get hung on us a third of the way through the movie that he can't work because everyone assumes he murdered his wife and we don't really get anything else on that except it does kind of lead to an interesting interplay of the fact that like, all right, if he was saying that he was out of control or something accidentally happened, yet he has this like amazing control over his dog and stuff like that. But anyway, I really dug it and I was like, By the final scenes of the movie, I was definitely on the hook for two things. Number one, I've watched every Quentin Tarantino movie. That man is famous for his gore. He's famous for violence. He's famous for fetishizing it and putting it next to a good soundtrack. And as we kind of build closer and closer to the idea, you know, we get the kind of the cunning of the Manson family as Brad Pitt goes and has his interaction on Spahn Ranch. And then we're getting closer and closer to what I'm assuming is just going to be a vile Quentin Tarantino rendition of this gruesome, grisly, insane murder. And then our heroes save the day. And I was delighted by it. And I just really, really, really dug it. I had a great time.
Brian, I think you saw it next.
Oh, I saw it last night, but I have a different take from both Justin and Bryce.
I saw it last night at 10:00.
Oh, okay. Oh, great. Okay, yeah. So the you see that Andy Kaufman bit where he gets on stage and does a really, really bad stand-up act that you just begin to pity him and you feel like what are you even doing? And then he starts to do impressions and they're all bad. And then suddenly busts out Elvis and it's amazing. And the majority of the act was kind of garbage. And the only laughter was nervous laughter because it was bad. And then at the end, it turns out he's like, got you suckers. And then if you didn't know who Elvis was or think it was very good singing, then I can understand why you would think that was just a bad stand-up act. But if you knew who Elvis was, you're like, holy crap, that was pretty amazing. Yeah. I hated my experience of the majority of this movie. And it was only at the end where I was, you know, just bursting out laughing and the audience was clapping and making noise because it was so outrageous and so far out there. And it's only after I established the idea that he was on purpose doing an Andy Kaufman bit or pulling a magic trick that I went back and I was like, okay, I hated the random wedging in of Bruce Lee to no significant import in this scene that basically exists only to say that Brad Pitt can beat up Bruce Lee. But then, by having seen the end, I was like, but that was really important to credibly set up amazing magical kung fu skills to grab a knife midway and all of the, I hated all of the Sharon Tate. Oh, didn't she deserve more life than she was granted? Look at that starry eyed doe-like enthusiasm for, you know, oh, what a lovely girl. I hated all that. It was boring and didn't add anything. And it was like, we get it. It sucks that she's going to die. But after you get to the end, you're like, all that was absolutely vital for us to be completely shocked. I hated the fact that in the last 30 minutes, randomly a narrator shows up and begins increasingly tediously counting down the minute by minute. At the moment, I hated it. But again, that was important to get the gotcha of it being an alternate timeline or whatever. So if you think of the movie as a magic trick, it was a very good Kaufman-esque magic trick. And you can make the case that everything that was there had to be there in order to get the punch at the end that we get. But having said that, I like the ending so much that it makes me look past the torture of the first 80%.
Now, do you think it's one of those things where you'll never watch it again, or if you watch it again, you will enjoy these moments more knowing that they're building to something and not being frustrated by them laying themselves out?
I suspect the latter, but I also suspect that given its length, I will never watch it again. But I will treasure the ending experience.
I will say, in general, Quentin Tarantino movies, pro tip, just put them on your phone. Because they're, in general, there's like, they kind of cut themselves up into smaller acts, or like in Pulp Fiction, they're literally their own little vignettes. They're just great when the internet is done and you're like pulling into landing. It's just like perfect little 15-minute, 20-minute moments, because the movies are so gosh darn long.
My experience was different. And you know, it is what's nice about going to see this with my girlfriend is, I'm a guy that knows a ton of Hollywood history, or thinks I know a lot, know about, I think I read the Vincent Pugliosi book, you know, and Manson, all that stuff. So like, I know a lot about the stuff. And so I go into that side of it of like, I'm fascinated by, I live in Hollywood. I'm fascinated by this stuff. I know these locations and stuff. And so that's me, you know, my girlfriend, you know, she's just starting off with her interest in, you know, diving into films and stuff like that. And so she has a very, very, very different experience in that. And so we're, you know, I'm like, I see the Bruce Lee thing. I'm like, oh, I know what this event is actually about. It's not pulled out of completely thin air from Quentin Tarantino. I'm like, I know who the stuntman this is based upon. I know some of the background on this. I know these little details. So I'm like, oh, cool. I'm like, I like the fact that Tarantino loved this part of the story, or loved this, or loved that. So that's my, you know, my point of view. And it's like, for me, the choices are like, oh, cool, he's going to do this story, or he's going to do this, he's going to incorporate this into there. She's looking at it from very fresh eyes without that. What was your opinion? She's just, you loved it? She loved it. Because she's watching the performances. She's just watching the characters build and this thing build in front of her and the mythology happening for the first time for her. So that was, you know, that, so that, that's, you know, because I could walk out of there going, well, if you know, if you read the book, then you appreciate this, which is not a way for everybody to enjoy a film. There are Tarantino, like my feeling, a lot of Tarantino movies, they're movies that I love, but there are these long lulls that drive me nuts. And then he does something brilliant that makes up for it. And so, Brian, I see what you're saying there, but oddly for me in this one, there was never a lull. Every frame, every scene, every moment, I was loving it. Like, you know, all the stuff that came before of watching the characters and their story, because I'm looking at, like, you know, what does the Hollywood machine do? You know, you're on TV and you're famous, and then all of a sudden, you know, nobody cares anymore, or you're trying to struggle and you're going, you know, with the Rick Dalton character going like, what's next? Spaghetti Westerns. And we didn't know that this was going to be the big turnaround for Clint Eastwood. You know, we didn't know that that actually could be an amazing thing, because for some people it wasn't. I loved it. In the moment that Rick Dalton opens up the shed by the pool and I see the flamethrower sitting in the corner, a little part of me is going, Chekhov's flamethrower. But I didn't know where it was going, because it was getting towards the end where the Manson people showed up. I'm like, now the fun's going to end. You know, now the fun's going to end and we're going to get to the bad part. And I love the moments of Sharon Tate, because she was one of these people that all you hear is one of the peer that she was supposed to be this really sweet person. And we got the story where we didn't let them, you know, we'll get into the ending, but like, you know, we get to see her being young and being in Hollywood and the myth, but maybe the myth was real for her. And then it became a nightmare, but this story was different. So I was in love with the movie and I was actually dreading the end because of what happened. And then when it happened, I'm like, oh my God, Inglourious Basterds this. And I loved it. It's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He tells us it's once upon a time. You go back, you're like, oh yeah. The narration thing, Brian, the narration was at the beginning too, when they talked about the relationship between Dalton and Cliff, but it's sporadic and it's easy to sort of say like, wait, you know, where did this come from?
You're right. Now that you mention it, that was in there, but I guess it does speak to my feeling pacing was a bit off. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to criticize on technical points. You know, it's because at the end of the day, it was unpleasant and boring for the vast majority of it. But I'll only remember that ending. I'll not remember.
Yeah, mine was opposite. Like, I loved that world building. I loved watching Dalton. I loved like what is a day in the life of Cliff Booth? These people are going, what's next? Where does life go from here? You know, and that's the story of the Hollywood fade. You know, it was a fan. You know, Tarantino's love letter to what the idolized version, while getting into some of the gritty version, and then using myth making did give us a happy ending. And I was curious, like, what did Sharon Tate's family's and her sister, you know, her sister was effusive about the movie. She loved the fact that Sharon got presented in a very good light, and the idea that the story ultimately wasn't about, you know, leaving it with the story of like, then let's follow the murderers. It's like, no, let's follow Sharon Tate on a happy day being a sweet person and whatnot. And I'm like, wow, I don't know if it's the right take. I loved it, enjoyed it, and it's what I love about it. It's a risky friggin' movie. And I'll say nothing but you, like, what I liked about, like, you know, some Spike Lee movies, like, if you ask me, like, do I agree with the meta points? I'm like, I don't know. Maybe it's a little too whatever. But in the reality of the movie, like Black Klansman, when you watch the sections and stuff, when you see them go to the Black Power movement and all that, it's powerful. You're like, oh, shoot. You're like, you're telling a guy who, like me, who has absolutely no understanding or experience of this, you're giving me a very good reason for why this is meaningful and impactful to these people. And I understand a little bit better. You know, you've opened up my worldview, and let me see what you're trying to show me. And that's what I love about Tarantino, because Tarantino could take a movie that I would go, it's a crappy movie. Like, yeah, but look at this. This is what's really cool about this. This sequence right there, it's great. And I'm like, oh, well, that is cool. Okay. And that's
kind of what I mean, I think the big grand stroke with that ending is set up in a moment after DiCaprio and Pitt see Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski go up to their house, you know, next door basically. And he's like, this is the reason why you have to live in Hollywood, because next door, you know, there's the director of Rosemary's Baby, and like, I could be a pool party away from my career being totally different. And then that end where it's like the pool party happens to be them foiling one of the most grisly, gruesome murders in history. And then he gets this validation of like, oh my God, like, is Cliff okay? And he's like, oh, these like gigantic luminaries, these like shooting stars in Hollywood know and revere me. And now like we can, like, that's the happy ending. The fact that that's the happy ending, and now we can imagine that Cliff gets more work and everything is happy. And we've averted one of the most awful murders in American history. It's just like, wow, that's just kind of really clever. It was something that I felt emotionally kind of carried that weight of all those characters, considering like all the time. And I'm with you, Brian. Like there were moments that for me felt a little Tarantino's doing this because he's Tarantino. And literally the only person that was ever able to tell him to keep his run times down has now been Me Too'd into oblivion. So he has nobody that is going to ever yell at him for putting in or taking out anything that he wants. But everything on that side that I felt was indulgent kind of played into our final things. Like they played into our final moments of Cliff being super competent and DiCaprio being longing for this this break beyond the break that he had. And we get everything. We get everything tied up in this like meta history shredding kind of finale, which is, it's I think if you think about like, what do you want from a certain director? Like that's the kind of stuff that you want from a Tarantino.
I like in the surprise. That's what I liked. I'm so glad I had no idea that it gave us this alternate ending to it. I loved that that happened, and I didn't know that it was coming, and then it happened, and then I'm still trying to process this and go, is this? And I've talked about this before we did this. The show is like there was a trailer out not before this, but for another movie about Sharon Tate, which just tries to turn the murders into this like a horror franchise sort of thing, and it just sounds so exploitive, just so not, hey, what a loss this wonderful person was and her friends were. It's this, let's take this horrible event and turn it into, put it on the level of, that bothered me. And then, I was curious to see this. We're like, oh yeah, we're going to take this event at the end and we're going to do our own myth making with it. And the idea is like, let's just make the killers friggin' buffoons. Let's not watch you walk away and think now the story is about what happens to the killers. The story is about like, wasn't she great? Weren't these people neat? Aren't they cool? And then when reality sets in, it's like, what have we lost? Having her watch actual Sharon Tate footage was brilliant. I mean, I love that because now, you've got millions of people have now seen Sharon Tate doing fun physical comedy and get an idea of who she was by watching her real performances. I mean, that alone to me was a neat way to sort of say, let's talk about this rising talent, what we lost. I loved that.
I mean, you do have to kind of peek around Margot Robbie's feet, but
yeah, there's that.
So one of the gripes that that Bonnie has in general is whenever is that so many movies when you have young beautiful women in there, so often they're whether it's by direction or by their acting choices is just the starry-eyed, vacant, half-smiling look. Bonnie hates that, and I was there in the movie. And bored enough that when they got to that time, there was so much time of them depicting that I had time to pull out my phone, snap a picture of her starry, faraway look, and text Bonnie, "You would effing hate this movie." So I don't know. I'm glad she didn't go. I don't think she would have enjoyed it at all.
Well, but it's I don't know what I don't know how to do the take on because it is Sharon Tate had that sort of that quality to our guests and sort of thing. And like I said, the sister being happy with the movie and liking the portrayal was great. The Manson, the girls, like you had some great friggin' performances there, like friggin' creepy, like,
it was the most natural Lena Dunham performance I've ever seen.
Yeah. Oh, was she the underage girl?
No. Lena Dunham of Girls fame.
Right. Was she the mama bear one or which
she
one?
Was? Yeah. Not the redhead that was inside with George Spawn, but she was the one that greets them. That's kind of like you find out is kind of playing quarterback on like.
Oh, got it. Yes. I see. Gypsy. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Dakota Fanning, all of that. I mean,
Dakota Fanning was great. I mean,
Squeaky Fromm. She was just.
She was great. Awesome. And I thought that was a great, and that's, it's like you see that scene or that whole sequence of Brad Pitt coming to the Manson ranch and everything. And you just like, that's the scene that like I bought like totally. If I would have ever thought like, oh, this might be some Tarantino playing around with history kind of thing, I was all in on like, okay, I know who the Manson family is. I know how competent they are. I know how dangerous they are. I know that they are highly paranoid and motivated, and they would not hesitate to do physical damage and kill somebody to keep off the radar, but they're not very competent.
Well, so the add to it, like the Hollywood history I knew, I'm like, oh damn, they did kill a stuntman who went there asking questions about Span. You know, like they did kill, like, and so I'm like, oh crap, are they gonna do that with so like I'm like for you know, yeah. Brad Pitt's character was like an extra turmoil for me because I'm like, oh yeah, those were the other murders that don't get any attention were the other people they killed, including a stunt guy who was asking questions and stuff. I'm like, who they thought turned him into the cops, you know? So I was kind of like, oh crap, he's dead. I'm like, man, I'm going to miss him. And then he drove off and I'm like, oh wow, they're not doing that story. And then I didn't realize, Andrew, it's all going to have a happy ending.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I guess that is the kind of headline. The headline is Quentin Tarantino does a Manson murder story with a happy ending.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it seems like a very Quentin Tarantino top line. Like, this is what my movie's going to be, man. Like, I'm going to do a Manson murder movie with a happy ending.
Which sounds horrible on the surface because you're like, oh, you're going to make them out. You're going to mythologize them, make them look good. And it's like,
yeah,
no.
Besides, it's also his like fan fiction theory of like how he could have saved Roman Polanski's career too. That it's just like, oh man, Polanski, great, what a great guy, like what a bright rising directorial star.
Oh wait, what do you mean by representing him so positively? It's a current day effort to rehabilitate his image.
Even reminding people that like, oh look, Polanski was this. Like icon, this rising star icon in the world of film. And then not only does he have this unspeakable tragedy happens to him, but then everything that happens afterward that, you know, he is still unable to return to America because he hasn't faced his crimes.
Tragedy bought Polanski a lot more forgiveness and tolerance for the bad things he did. That tragedy
I agree. Yeah.
So I don't know that if it had it not happened, it would have rehabilitated him as much as he probably would have had a bigger downfall sooner.
Oh, no. I think Justin's saying this movie right now, today, is a sincere effort to say, hey, America, why don't we think a little more charitably about Roman Polanski today?
Oh, no. I don't think it's saying to our modern audience that should be happening. I'm saying that, like, in the same way that he can unwrite out the Manson murders, he can unwrite out history when it comes, although they do lay the track of like, hey, look, the other best friend that was there at the
Sebring.
Yeah. That was there at the house is like, he knows that Polanski's going to screw up and he wants to be there when it happens. So they do set up that Polanski's not this, you know, choir boy, obviously,
you know, the Damian Lewis, Steve McQueen. Was
great.
Cool. Yeah, it was cool. Because like, I'm like, this is like barely looks like Steve McQueen, but in that moment, in that scene, he's a great, Steve McQueen. You know, messed up hair and stuff, and then explaining to us what's I loved it. I love that it was a risky choice. It's a very, very, very risky choice to say in a big movie like this with stars like this to say it. It could have, and it's got, you know, some critics, it's divided as far as like, was this a good idea, a bad idea, whatever, but bless Tarantino for like, you know, he had the balls or the insanity, maybe more insanity to like, I'm going to rewrite how World War II ended, you know? And then he's like, and it's funny because I've heard people like defend that, like, well, that was okay there because it was just a different, like, what, the Holocaust didn't like kill millions of people and Hitler wasn't a real, I was like, you know, like to defend that and not this. It's like, if you're on board with him, like wiping out Hitler and stopping World War II prematurely in his fictional thing, I think you got to be okay with him, you know, wiping out this.
Yeah, the one thing that I would say is that Tarantino has made a point to say that he makes two kinds of movies and you should expect different realities from the real world movies that are about characters that should be taken as more realistic, and that's Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. And then there's the movies that he can, that he's making, that would be movies that those characters would watch. And that's the Kill Bill and Glorious Bastards. And this is spends the vast majority of the movie as his first kind of real world movie since Jackie Brown, and then ends with the kind of ending that we got in both Inglourious Basterds, and to a lesser extent, because it's not a famous thing, Django Unchained.
One last note I'll point out is the detail they went into to recreate 1969 was incredible, because they used a lot of real locations. They actually used, you know, places, redressed, went back and put, you know, facades and, you know, I'm sure they probably did digital stuff too, and they had to for certain things, but I'd imagine, but so much of it was actually facades and stuff on, you know, newer buildings to make them look like the older versions, all of that. When she's in Westwood walking around, if you go there, that's a real place, whatever. I was just so impressed. And, you know, you're sitting there watching this in, you know, a Burbank movie theater next to other people who were all just like looking at this world as, you know, Pitt's driving the car through town, and you're like, holy crap. Like, it's amazing how good of a job they did in that. So,
all right, one last thought. So it's a movie by an established director about Hollywood that stars a bunch of A-list actors and did well at the box office. This has got to be Tarantino's like most Oscar-baity movie of all time. And not to say that he made it like that, but just that in terms of award viability, it checks a lot of boxes that the Academy traditionally rules.
I mean, I'm not going to say that it was a cynically targeted attempt to win an Oscar, but in an alternate reality, if somebody were to manufacture a cynically Oscar targeted movie, it would be indistinguishable from this one.
Oh, no, no, no. I think that's La La Land. Like, that's where you're just doing like, oh, no, we're going to do an old movie for old voters, and we're going to ape this kind of thing. At the very least, this movie.
Trumbo. I was like, Trumbo. Because it's like, let's tell you this, even, you know, take a character who's maybe more flawed than we realize, not show you, but aren't we great, great, great. And not, you know, like I said, the risk of like rewriting the Manson murders could have gone either way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and even the Hollywood stuff is like, it doesn't, you know, we are happy because we like DiCaprio that, you know, he survives, but it's a fairly critical portrait of an actor's ego and the kind of mollycoddling that has to happen around it. But I don't know. I think it's like, this will be interesting, because as far as, you know, far as I can tell, and obviously we're like a month and a half, 2 months away from like Oscar movie season, but I would not be surprised if this is nominated for a lot.
Yeah, I thought the performances were fantastic. I mean, I thought, you know, was Leonardo doing what makes Leonardo great? You know, that watching an actor portray an actor who could then act in a way that different, like, that was so multi-layered, you know, the things that were subtle, you know, about, you know, that the character has this stammer that he does pretty good job of covering up, but he's about to stammer, but he doesn't stammer. And then when he's alone and angry, he just mocking himself and that. And you realize, wow, there's a lot going on inside there. I just loved it. Loved it.
All right. Well, we settled it.
I think our takes are pretty representative of how our audience is going to feel. I think that it's going to be, you know, like, I have friends who I know are going to be more like, you know, Brian and Bryce and how they feel about it. And that's kind of, I haven't seen Hateful Eight yet, because like that trailer bored me. Like, I'm like, bunch of people in a small contained environment talking, least favorite. I'm not a Kill Bill fan, not a Kill Bill fan. You know, like Tarantino, like sometimes I'm like, I love it. Sometimes I'm like, people love some of his stuff, and I'm like, not for me. This is not what I want. So, like, Brian, like, I'm you in some of his other stuff. So,
well, yeah. I mean, look, Hateful Eight is, I think, probably the least accomplished of the movies that he's done. It's basically just it's like an all-star game with all the gravity and weight of an all-star game, where it's like the stakes really don't matter. And this is basically just a script where he's like, oh, let me just cast all the people that have been in other movies of mine that I really like. And we're just going to give them this like scenery chewing dialogue and they're just going to go. And so if you're a fan of Tarantino movies, I think you'll enjoy it. But Hateful Eight to me, I mean, his worst movie is Death Proof, but Hateful Eight is probably the most, you know, the least of consequence to see.
But you see him like he took, so I was saying, like Zoe Bell and Kurt Russell from Death Proof and then kind of put him into versions of those characters in a way into here.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally. That was a fun moment. Is you know, I don't know, Kurt Russell's always great. And I mean, for however superfluous the narrator was, I thought, you know, that's another Tarantino favorite move is like, hey, famous friend, just do this narration for me.
What I think would be cool. If you're interested in Hollywood mythology, I would love, I mean, Tarantino really doesn't do like director's commentaries or stuff does. Like, I would love to see a breakdown in there because it's like, there's so many references in here that I got, but I know there's so many more that I didn't get, you know, like when you had, you know, Cliff Booth, the flashback of him on the boat with, you know, his wife, Rebecca Gayhart, you know, just nagging him. And she's like, well, my sister Natalie said that you're no good, da, 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 da. Allusion to Natalie Wood dying off of a boat with Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken and that mystery of what happened and stuff. And like little things like that. I'm like, shoot, what else do I not know? Because with, you know, Tarantino, it's like,
I mean, I agree. It's so dense. Deep. Every scene, so many references.
Every frame. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's like one of like the weird little, and I think for Tarantino, that's like the little flaw that makes the character is like, you just really love Brad Pitt and you're rooting for Brad Pitt and you're like feeling bad when he can't get on the set. And then it's like, oh yeah. Like, it's just one of those things in Hollywood that it's like, oh, whatever happened to Mike? Why isn't he working? Oh, he probably killed his wife. We don't know. Moving on. Who's ready for lunch?
I, you know, like I said, though, it's good. Like, I liked fact getting, asking my girlfriend who's, these references are all new to her, and to have her go like, well, what did you think? And she just loved it because she just looked at it for what was on the screen and not the story that like I brought in with me. Like, well, I hope they get into this. And if they do that, I will check this off on a list, you know, which,
yeah,
it's probably the way I, you know, view some of these things. Yay. I know that thing.
Yeah.
And so, cool. Any picks?
Continuing to enjoy Pessimist's Archive. It's a great podcast.
I don't know that.
We talked about it. It was a previous pick. Maybe it was the week you were out, but it's the story of all these fairly uncontroversial things nowadays and how they were all hated when they first came out. Demonized. Stuff like The Waltz, The Novel.
The Irish.
The Walkman. They did chain stores, electricity. Like, just nobody knows how to process, so the first thing they do is they hate it.
Yeah, and so I had this conversation with was Tom Merritt. We're at like one of the Sword and Laser meetups, and the conversation brought up about like how somebody brought up, but it was a good point. It was about like, hey, like, you know, these heads of these tech companies, you know, they don't let their kids, you know, have much screen time, you know, and they limit their screen time. I'm like, well, you know, like Apple limits, you know, has software to limit screen time, all that, but I'm like, we don't know that screen time is bad, you know, like we call it screen time. Because we might as well call it electricity time. You know, do we good or bad? You
right.
Know,
or connected to other humans time.
That was the case I made. I said I went home and the fact that I read a book, was that better than hopping online and talking to six friends and developing relationships and friendships? I don't know.
Yeah, you'd really enjoy Pessimist's Archive. One of the tropes that he does is he gets people who host podcasts celebrating these things to read the quotes from 100, 200 years ago, demonizing them, which is a fun twist.
That's great.
That's awesome. Cool. Heroin.
Yeah.
That's future episode. Yeah. Until we get to it there. Cool. Anybody else?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my pick's the movie. That's pretty much all I watched over the weekend.
Cool.
Fresh? Yeah, I don't have a second pick this week. It's hard to do two things in a week.
so hard to pick one thing out of the infinite world of media we've consumed to say.
Okay.
I passed on it to Bryce, but I will pick on you because I'm that guy.
Last week I talked about Slay the Spire, and I think Slay the Spire is still a really fun single player card game, and it's pretty fun.
Let me tell you what, picking up on earlier picks is a good thing because sometimes like, hey, I love this thing, but coming back, I'm like, hey, I still love this thing is valid because that's when I started to go, huh, you know, it's interesting.
Sure. Slay the Spire. It's a good single player card game, and it makes you really think about like deck building when it comes to these card games. And it lets you do some wacky stuff because it's a roguelike, so you'll play for 30 minutes at a time and have to start over because you died. So, yeah, it's on the PC, and it's on the Switch. It's really good on the Switch, too.
Cool. I decided I was going to try to go rewatch some of the Snyder DC films to sort of, like, allow time and distance and all that to kind of go do it. And it took me about a week to make it through Man of Steel. And I got past all the things that annoyed me. Cause that list was already in my head, you know, like that was there. Like I already got past what was annoyed me. And I said, what do I like about it? And you know, I thought like, man, there are some really cool visuals in here. There are some really cool visuals or some cool things there. So I made it through the end and I liked. And I think my favorite part of that was like the Krypton stuff, you know, like I still kind of dig the Krypton stuff. It's like, I would have watched a whole prequel if only somebody did like a whole series that was more like that than I guess what we have with Krypton. But I dug that. I'd actually dug that part, you know, and I just wish we spent more time with the Kryptonians when they came and showed up instead of just like, hey, I'm here. I'm Zod. Give me Superman. And now we're going to punch each other, which is like, all right, that's frustrating. But there were parts I liked. And I said, okay, let me go watch. There's the Batman versus Superman extended cut. Let me go back and try that.
Let me guess, it was not good.
I couldn't make it. I'm like 10 minutes in, 15 minutes in, and I'm like, I can't. I get longer sequence of Jesse Eisenberg and his character, and I see now the difference between his character there and Zuckerberg and stuff. You know, and him as an actor, he's fine there, but it's not, I don't like him. It's not compelled by it. It's just, to me, I couldn't. So I went and watched Zombieland, my girlfriend again, and hadn't seen Zombieland in years. We loved Zombieland. Zombieland was fun, great fun movie. And then next day, wake up, check my RSS feed. What about Zombieland?
Yeah, Zombieland 2, right?
Double tap.
I'm excited. Yeah. So there you go.
Did they ever make that Amazon Zombieland series, or was that just a pilot? Because I feel like
homie got all pissed off on Twitter and like lit into fans or something about it. So that's all. It got weird.
Yeah, I think that was when Amazon was doing the whole like
pilot season.
Vote on the pilots. They were like crowdsourcing the like, hey, do you like this? We'll make more.
It's a horrible idea because in a world where you look at how many times you make your way through the pilot and then it gets better two or three episodes in, because that's when executives start to let, you know, them do their thing. Sometimes it's finding your footing. Sometimes it's like fighting, getting past the arguments of what the show needs to be and letting the show be the thing it needs to be. And then it gets really good. And so, you know, it was frustrating. So anyhow, looking forward to it. Yeah. Cool. All right, gentlemen, it's been After.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.